and welcome to the broadcast. I'm your host, David Brooks, and this week we're talking about buyout. I'm joined by Roshni Sakaria, Actuarial Manager in the Pensions and Risk Transfer Team at L&G, Jonathan Hazlett, Head of Pensions at Osborne Clark, and our very own Mark Channon, Actuarial Director in our Smart Insure Risk Transfer Team. Hello to you all. Just wave. It's a podcast, no one can see it, but that's okay. So we're going to talk about the buyout market, what's been going on over the last 12 months, and looking forward to the future. So Roshni, I wanted to start with you really, and what your 2023 was like, or what L&G's 2023 was like. I know you weren't there for all of it. Anyway, again, we're not going to get into that. But how was 2023 from L&G's perspective?
Well, it's no surprise it's been 50 billion, so it was very busy. I guess it was a very record-breaking year just for the buyout market in general, and in particular for L&G as well, with our 33 transactions in the UK coming to around 12 billion. And, following the spike we've seen in demand, we had some record-breaking transactions like the BSPS, the now largest to have insured all their members, as well as the largest single transaction, which was the Boots one, towards the end of the year. Obviously, the market's now seen over 2.5 billion transactions in 1 year. So we probably all remember that one day in November where, the two big transactions were announced, Boots and the co-op one. I think it's been a very successful year for L&G and just insurers all around.
Yeah. No, Jonathan, is that a similar experience?
It's been very similar for us as legal advisors. It's a very busy market, as Roshni said, 50 billion of deals, and I'm sure that's going to increase even further next year. I think that has presented challenges for insurers in terms of resources, but also actually for trustees and their professional advisors as well. There's a lot of activity going on. Similarly with Roshni, we've seen the sort of size of deals increasing, not been involved in any of those record-breaking transactions, unfortunately, but we've still seen much larger schemes coming through. I think we've been interested as legal advisors to start seeing some of the new entrants coming in. You had Canada Life writing its first deferred buy-in policy. We've done a transaction with Canada Life fairly recently, and I'm sure we're going to see other new entrants coming through, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. And then from a purely personal level, on a risk settlement basis more generally, we were involved in the Debenhams Superfund transaction. I was the trustee to the Debenhams trustees, which followed quite closely the first one with Sears. So I think, we may well be going into a time when there's alternatives to bulk purchase annuity. So yeah, as I said, very busy year and some exciting developments.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, or Broadstone's perspective, we're looking more at the smaller end of the market. So I guess what we saw was that back end of 2022 and throughout 2022 really, as gilt yields rose, we suddenly got this glut of schemes come into a position where they could afford to transact where they perhaps couldn't previously. But they tended to be those schemes that weren't fully hedged against interest rate risks. So talking generally, they're probably the schemes that weren't as well prepared to suddenly come to market and transact. So we probably spent the first half of 2023 picking up those schemes, getting them transaction ready rather than actually processing deals. Whereas the second half of 2023, we then saw that come to fruition and put through a lot more. And we're seeing that now going into 2024 is those schemes that we've prepared now are now going across, and it's actually the deals that are happening now.
I think, Mark, that focus on small to medium sized schemes is going to increase over the mm-hmm. next few years, because as you said, there's a lot of business to go for there, isn't there? And the focus of insurers today has been on those large transactions where if you get selected, there's a lot more money to be made from those. But there's a huge amount of schemes that are well funded now and will be coming to the bulk annuity market over the next few years.
Yeah, I agree with that. And even from an insurer's perspective, we all talk about those large schemes, but those mid-size and smaller ones aren't forgotten. And I think insurers all around are working to sort of make streamline processes where we can sort of cater to those and make sure they're still coming through. And those small ones do add up for us as well.
Yeah, and I think what we've seen as well is with the insurers is those smaller schemes that are coming to market, they are aware of the number that are coming across, and they're also aware of the amount of work that's involved in taking them on. And they are preparing solutions that looks to streamline that process. And that was something we saw probably before 2023. I think LNG were one of the forerunners in this, but certainly there's a few insurers out there now looking at their processes to come in and take schemes on of a smaller size at pace.
Yeah, and I think that's what, you know, selfish plug here, but what we've done well between us, isn't it, at Broadstone, Oswin Clark, through the Smart Insurer, is getting those streamlined, standardised processes in place for small to medium-sized schemes. And it's a bit of a hackneyed phrase, but sort of getting buyout ready and doing that in advance. And a large part of our year as well was doing those feasibility assessments and the benefit specifications and the codification of discretions, all those things, data as well, that you need to do before you can go to the market. And that's just going to increase as well.
I was interested because I was looking at some of the stats for 23, and you could really see, I think, the points you're both, all three of you, are making. You know, perhaps, yeah, there's the economic change through 22, albeit with the exciting spike in the autumn, and then half one was busy, and probably record busy, but busy. But the second half was something else. You know, it really was. And you accept as well, it's curtailed slightly by not much happening in December. So within sort of 5 months, there was a hell of a lot of work happening. And I suppose taking from that, looking through to 24, are you just seeing everyone just sort of getting better at this? I'm not sure who I'm going to throw this at. I think Roshni, I'm going to let you go and take this one. But, you know, everyone's all getting better at this now. This isn't new, you know, buyout isn't new, but we're all getting better at just getting those deals done and getting those situations sorted.
Well, I mean, even if you just look back 5 years from 2023, you know, 30 billion over 5 years, and then we've gone to 2023, which was 50 billion just in the 1 year. And, you know, this year we're just expecting volumes to be equally or higher. I think the UK market's expecting 50 to 60 billion around that much. And I think insurers have always sort of managed to keep up with the demand. You know, we've, even like within LNG, we've increased capacity, we've made sure like we're sort of there technology wise, people wise, and I do think it's not easy, but you know, the markets, like insurers, have been good at keeping up with the market demand, and we sort of see that we're going to have another successful year and deliver sort of optimal pricing.
Yeah, I think we've seen that. I don't think we've ever not had a transaction that hasn't been able to secure members' benefits. But I do think what the market is like at the moment, resources, is certainly those small to medium-sized schemes are definitely sort of adopting that, sort of not doing the full whole of market broking that we used to be used to, but perhaps identifying just one insurer that they're going to work with. And I don't know whether you've seen that as well, Mark, with your client base.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're probably working within a subset of the insurers out there for a number of the schemes that we take to market. Anything kind of sub 20 million, maybe even sub 50 million, that you're certainly working within a very limited range of insurers that would be looking to quote on that. And by focusing it within the Smart Insure team at Broadstone, we are able to be taking deals, you know, a couple of months almost to market. And that means that we can work much more efficiently. We can leverage our existing knowledge based on going through a number of deals recently and getting those through quickly and doing what the insurers want us to do to be able to get a nice, clean, easy transaction through.
I think just to add to that, obviously there is the pricing side, but you know, at LNG we're also working with our admin side to make sure we have that gold standard for our members, and you know, Mark, we were speaking a couple of weeks back, and we're trying to make sure we're through and through prepared for this sort of influx of small schemes that we're expecting.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a trend where a lot of the work is being done up front, and this is almost a requirement of the streamlined processes that the insurers like LNG are putting in place, that we're making sure the benefits are really tight, the data is really good when we enter into a transaction, such that post-transaction phase is relatively quick and straightforward to go through. So we're definitely almost shifting the process a bit. So we might only be going to one insurer, but we're doing a lot of work up front, making it really, really, really well prepared before we go to that insurer. And then that post-transaction part becomes a lot smoother and a lot shorter.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're seeing, actually, if there are resource constraints, is actually more in the buy-in to buy-out conversion, because the broker will, you know, do the deal, the trustees enter into the transaction, but there's obviously a huge amount of data cleansing that might last, you know, 12, 18, 24 months. And I think that's a challenge for the industry to get people who specialise in that area, understand what they're doing, to ultimately discharge the liabilities at the very end.
You know, I was just thinking about, this might be a question for you, Jonathan and Mark, is kind of that you're working with clients, perhaps some of them are, you know, hot to trot, so they're thinking, right, our funding's in the right place. And I'm just wondering how you have that conversation to say that it's a busy market, we're going to have to do a bit of work to get you looking as best you can. So there's, so I'm trying to think it through. So what Roshni sees might not be quite as a sort of a dramatic, you come sort of swan-like to Roshni going, here we go, we're ready. But there's been a lot of work. And also there's been a few other ugly ducklings that haven't quite made it. They're at the back of the, you know, the other side of the dam or whatever, you know, waiting to be tidied up, ready. And I just, Jonathan, I'm going to throw it to you first. How are you seeing that work with sort of employers and trustees you work with?
Well, I think from a legal perspective, we do keep getting these curveballs, which sort of slightly sort of knock you sideways. So, I mean, the most obvious one to think about at the moment is Virgin Media. Yeah, it was an unhelpful judgment for trustees and employers. And, you know, for those listeners who don't know, it's essentially a case about whether amendments that are made to contracted out schemes needed an actuarial confirmation or an actuarial certificate to say that the schemes were continued to satisfy the contracting out status. Now, you know, the High Court has held that those confirmations are required, but that point is being appealed to the Court of Appeal. So, you know, where we thought we had a load of amendments that were effective, there's that possibility that they may not be. And so that is an extra piece of work we've had to do. And it's difficult to manage with employees and trustees if they think their data is in a good place and they understand the benefits. And then we as legal advisors come back and say, perhaps that deed in 2008 wasn't effective, is a really difficult message, but it's one that we're managing. And I think a lot of trustees for the time being are just waiting to see what the outcome of the Court of Appeal decision is. But it's almost inevitable with every scheme, and I'm sure Mark will agree, that something will come out that hasn't been done properly, that needs to be investigated and quantified.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think I'd say, well, our first meeting almost with the trustees, when we go in and speak to a group of trustees about the process, one of the biggest things we talk about is benefit specifications and the need to get a legally reviewed benefit specification signed off early on, because in a good number of cases that can hold up the time to go to transaction, simply because benefits that are being administered aren't in line with what the rules say for one reason or another. You know, not finger pointing and saying it's anyone's particular fault, but these things happen. Deeds that you thought were effective weren't signed off correctly, and you end up having to go back and look at benefits and payment and reboot that, and you end up in a position where you thought you were fully funded, able to go and transact, but actually you're not where you thought you were, and there needs to be another project before you get to that point. And I think we have those conversations right up front. Trustees are generally receptive to it. I think probably across our client base, we see where you've got the independent professional trustees, the conversation is a lot easier. They've maybe been through a couple of these before and they know all the steps and they're aware of the timeframes. Sometimes an awkward conversation first time around with a group of lay trustees where you're saying, well, we're here now, but it's going to be 6 months until we get a quote, because they think where you take out insurance policies, you go to market, you get a quote the same day and you can spend a week thinking about it and enter it. So to say you have to wait 6 months, it's a bit of a shock. And then the other point is saying, because of the size of your scheme, you might have to go exclusive, which means we can only approach one insurer and get one quote. And obviously, you know, in the days of entering into your details onto a website and getting three comparative quotes straight away, that's a different approach to taking out an insurance policy compared to what you might do in your personal life. So it is kind of making the trustees aware that this is how the process runs, and it's not as straightforward as plugging in a few details and you get your quote.
I think it's a really difficult conversation as well with finance directors, aren't they? Particularly with underfunded schemes. They're saying, well, I've got this amount of money I'm prepared to put into the scheme. And they want to know that that's the exact amount. And there's never, you know, once they've paid that, the you know, the liabilities removed. And obviously that isn't the case. And, you know, it's a dynamic market. You can't completely guarantee what the pricing is going to be. And then as we've talked about, you know, data cleansing and so forth can bring up additional liabilities. So that's a difficult conversation to have.
Okay, let's just move on to perhaps a slightly more controversial area. There's lots of whispers in the press around concentration of risk or overfunded reinsurance. Roshni, this feels like a time to bring you back in to the room. I mean, just get your thoughts on that.
I think overall, I guess the concept of reinsurance isn't new, right? And it's just about being prepared of and actively aware of managing risks around funded re. And from an LNG perspective, you know, we have an active panel of insurance counterparties that quote on PRT business, and we have exposure limits in place based on various like factors, and we just make sure we use a diversified, well-rated set of reinsurers, and you know, we're constantly engaging with the PRA on all aspects of our portfolio. So I think, you know, insurers are aware of the risks and that they're doing everything to sort of manage those
I think from our point of view, well, firstly, I think it from my understanding is it's an essential part to ensure that there's capacity there to keep writing the level of business that's needed. If no funded rate is available, then we just suddenly the capacity would fall off as well. And we've talked previously about the number of schemes coming to market that would be constrained even further without it. But from a client point of view, though, I think it's certainly nothing that comes up in conversation with clients, whether they read to that level of detail around the insurers before entering into a transaction. I doubt it. The conversations we have around insurer covenant, they would typically, the vast majority of trustee boards would say that they rely on the regulatory regime that's in place with insurers to maintain strength across the industry. Occasionally, some will seek to do a covenant review on an individual insurer before entering into that transaction, potentially do several covenant reviews if they're doing a competitive process to understand which is the strongest insurer, if there's any concerns. But even that, I'm not sure to what degree the level of funded reinsurance comes up within those assessments.
Okay. So looking at the market, then, as it might develop, the public sector consolidator is something that, well, I don't know how seriously it is being considered by government. At least they've got a consultation on it at the moment, which ends in a few days after this podcast is being recorded. So what do you think? Is it going to happen? Is it a cause for concern? Oh, Jonathan's got his hand up. Excellent.
Well, given that I work very closely with the PPF, I think this actually will proceed. I think there's a lot of political will to do it, certainly by the current government. I think it's a little bit debatable, I think, whether an incoming Labour government would want to give this particular agenda priority with other competing legislation that they'd want to do. But certainly I know the PPF's working very hard and consulting about setting up a PSC by the end of 2026. So I think that we'll have another dynamic to the risk settlement market. I don't think I'm entirely convinced it's going to be a fundamental challenge to the current risk transfer market, because the target schemes are really those that are not sufficiently well funded for insurance or are not going to be attractive to commercial consolidators. So I think we're looking at a very small subset of smaller, less well funded schemes. But I don't know what Roshni thinks.
Yeah, I was going to say I agree with that completely. I think it's just going to provide an alternative end game solution for schemes that aren't quite attractive to commercial consolidators, as you said, and these are probably the schemes that aren't yet ready for the sort of buy and buy out, and you know, ultimately it's security of member benefits that is the focus.
Yeah, I think the policy challenge for government and the PPF, though, is to get the sort of investment in productive finance that the government wants to see through consolidation. They really do need to be more attractive than just these smaller, less well-funded schemes, because otherwise the policy objective just isn't going to be achieved. So I think it's going to happen, but I think it'll be a long-term solution, I suspect.
Yeah, I think to the extent that it's almost a Clara light, in that it's a Clara for the smaller schemes that Clara won't take on, or if a competitor to Clara comes into the market, then I think it's got to be welcomed, because if you've got schemes that don't have a home that are just drifting, to give them somewhere to go, I think it's got to be a positive. But I agree with Jonathan, based on the market, there doesn't seem to be a huge number of these schemes that potentially wouldn't have an option elsewhere within the risk transfer market to go to. I think they have to be careful how it's done to make sure we don't offer up an option at the expense of well-run schemes, for those schemes that don't put in the funding, the company not putting in the funding, just as seeing it as a cheap way out. I think it has to be a genuine, filling a genuine void that doesn't already exist.
Yeah, and I think the PPF, as I understand it, consulting on like a streamlined benefit structure to sort of reduce onboarding costs and running costs. And whilst that might be attractive to some, I think, you know, a lot of trustees, are going to still want to focus on insurance because it's the best protection for members' benefits. And even the super funds would say the same, that this is the greatest level of security that you can get for members' benefits.
I mean, I quite challenge that a little bit. For public sector, consolidator is backed by a 12 billion surplus in the PPF, possibly, or the government ultimately. Is that not?
I think that's going to be the key policy thing to come out of the legislation, is whether it does. So if the government underwrites it, then that would be great. But they don't underwrite the PPF as things stand. That's all got to be funded by levy payers. And as I understand it, there is a debate as to whether the PPF itself should stand behind it, or whether it's going to be a sort of separate standalone scheme where perhaps government funds the first years of its operation, but otherwise it's going to have to be self-sufficient. So I can see your point, Dave, if that's where we end up. Let's see how the legislation develops.
Yeah, it's a difficult, I mean, I'm spending some time reading the consultation for our own response, and it's going to be a difficult one. I mean, like Mark, I agree with Mark. I think lots of trustees will love to see this, and employers will love to see this as a way out, where otherwise they may need to run on for a long time and lots of costs of paying people like us to look after it when they'd rather not. And for the member security, what's Roshni's point as well about, ultimately this is about member security, and if this is needed for the market, then we should welcome it. There's just a few very careful bits they just need to make sure they weave it through and don't make trustees look at this too favorably. And it really is the harmonization might be a negative. You know, the scheme actually might be like, well, you know, there'll be winners and losers, and we already know through discussions about conversion and GMP equalization and things like that conversion is not always that attractive when there's winners and losers and you're making assumptions for the future. So hopefully they can make it unattractive enough for the schemes that could do better and just right for the schemes that would need it. Sorry, Mark. Yeah,
no, just to say, the point around harmonisation is interesting, because what we're seeing as well with some of the streamlined processes with the insurers is doing that to some degree as well. Not necessarily the degree that like a PPF type benefit is, but they might make certain changes to benefits to make it fit their streamlined model. So at the moment, it's an easier conversation to have to say, yeah, make some tweaks to your benefits if the end result is going to the insurer, because that is gold standard. Whereas if you're making tweaks anyway to go down the insurance route, and it's tweaks to go into a public consolidator, then potentially that conversation becomes a little bit different, a bit more difficult.
Yeah, and from a legal perspective, changing accrued benefits is very challenging. We have seen it in these streamlined approaches that's unusual. Pension increases, for example, can't be replicated. But in order to take those benefits away from people, as you'll know, Mark, you're going to need to have an actuarial certificate of equivalent value, or the members are going to have to agree. And those are quite difficult. It's a difficult judgment of the actuary, but very difficult if you have to go to members and ask them. And get them to fully understand what they'd be consenting to.
I was just thinking as well, guys, about whether there's any other sort of challenges. We've got productive finance headlines, you know, and so schemes are being encouraged to put money into probably more liquid funds, especially when they're targeting buyout. That may not be that attractive. Are there challenges around illiquids that are difficult to resolve? Jonathan, I don't know if you wanted to.
Well, it's certainly something we're finding we've got more problems with in buying transactions for schemes which have a significant proportion of the liquids. I mean, a lot of small to medium sized schemes won't, but the larger schemes will hold significant proportions of liquids. And obviously the best thing to do with an illiquid is to let it run on, not sell it and wait for it to mature, but that might not necessarily meet sort of the strategic objectives. So we've seen some insurers, I don't know whether Roshni has got experience of this, is sort of adopting deferred premium structures to deal with that, or otherwise selling it on the secondary market, or in some circumstances being able to transfer it to the insurer in specie. But that's obviously a challenge from a regulatory requirement. But I don't know what your recent experience of that has been, Roshni.
Yeah, so I think obviously schemes being funded earlier than expected has led to this sort of illiquids kind of bubble. But I think a lot of it is just working closely with us to see what solutions we can provide. I think we look to sort of be innovative and give bespoke solutions to schemes, whether that is, and we work closely with, we've got LGIM on our side as well, which kind of support us to get the best solution for the illiquids and the cases. And it is very case by case. And we've got, we do also consider deferred premium where it feels right for the scheme.
Yeah, so from my point of view, the small, medium sizes, as Jonathan says, it doesn't come up that often, but the odd time it has, it might be that particularly some of the smaller schemes may have a property investment, potentially linked to the employer as well. And the recent funding improvements has meant that can't be sold off in an orderly manner, as probably the original expectation was. And so each case probably gives its own difficulties with these illiquids, trying to come up with something innovative just to make sure that that asset can be sold in advance, potentially using the employer to give some kind of support as well, to help smooth the transition as well. But it's all a bit case by case is what we're finding.
Yeah, and I think it just emphasizes what we were talking about earlier about a lot of preparation, and the treatment of illiquids would be something that needs to be considered along the same lines as data and benefits and issues like that. So that's certainly been my experience, that where these issues have been identified up front, they're much more easily dealt with.
Yeah, agree, Jonathan. And like we as insurers are always saying, just speak to us early, just speak to us openly so that we can help as much as we can as well.
What a great way to end a podcast with a plea for early contact and offer of help. That's lovely. Well, on behalf of our listener, I will thank you all. So Roshni, Jonathan, Mark, thank you very much for your time. Talk to us today about the buyout market, the past and future, and we hope you enjoy the podcast. Thank you.